Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast.
Hi everybody, welcome to episode 137 of the podcast with me, Dan Prosser, and my co-host, Andrew Frankel. So this week's episode, well, it's a grown-up one, because we're talking about how to save Jaguar. The CEO stepped down last week, and so it leaves Jaguar in a seemingly perilous position. What is the future for Jaguar? We have a couple of newsy bits to get through first. But we get stuck into Jaguar very quickly. So thanks for listening. Enjoy the episode. This week we are talking about our plan to save Jaguar. We'll explain why in a moment. But Andrew, the first thing that we have to talk about is us, because you can now give a subscription to the Intercooler as a gift in plenty of time for Christmas, which is convenient timing, isn't it? So, I mean, we do need to talk about this a bit because we have to give it a good push, don't we? You have to head to the website, the-intercooler.com, and you'll find the gift page very easily from the homepage. You can give a 3, 6 or 12-month subscription, so it's very cost-effective. If you give a 12-month subscription, you get a 10% discount on the standard price. Gift subs do not auto-renew like normal subs. So, you know, when the term is up, you're not just going to get charged again for it automatically.
Yeah, that's a really important point to make.
It is. And I think hopefully it, you know, settles a few, answers a few questions. But also this one, gift subs are activated on the day they are redeemed by the recipient. So not on the day that you buy them. And they also don't expire. So you can buy a 12-month sub now, sit on it for 12 months. And even then, the recipient will get a 12-month subscription. We'll also send you a digital gift voucher right away, so it's fully automated. Couldn't be simpler.
Yeah. So I have two subs. I subscribe to The Week and The Economist, and I absolutely love it. But more than anything else, I love giving gift subs, because if the recipient wants it, and so it's my brother, I give him The Week every year. And it's just fantastic, because it's one less, you know, we all just hate about sitting there thinking, what are we going to get him? What are we going to get her? And every year, I don't have to think about it. It's literally, I don't even have to do anything. It's just such a, I'm being really selfish here, but it just makes one of the many, many problems of Christmas go away. And if you like what we do, and we hope that you do, and you think that there are, you know, you've got like-minded friends or family, then it's just a really, really easy thing to do. And if they like it, then it makes one particular problem go away for, you know, as long as they want it to. So, yeah, have a look.
So, the-intercooler.com. And it's important to say that if you give a gift sub, the recipient can use the Intercooler app and the website. There's no limitation on that apart from the duration of the subscription. And also, they will have full access to our entire library, which is growing by the day. It's 1,000 stories, 1,000,000 words, all there, ready, waiting to be read. I mean, you don't get that with a traditional magazine subscription, do you? You just get the physical copies that are sent to you. So there's a good benefit there. So there you go. You know, if you've got, if there's another petrol head in your life who you think would enjoy a subscription to the Intercooler, you can now give it as a gift. The-intercooler.com.
And so one final thing. The other thing I would say is that the vast majority of the stories that sit in our library, as you say, those, you know, more than 1,000 stories, more than 1,000,000 words, they're all timeless. They're not, you know, date stamped and therefore irrelevant the moment they've been published or a week later. Like, you know, so much stuff that you get in the magazines, it's, you know, it's tests of current stuff and, you know, and they go out of date. Whereas the vast majority of what we publish is genuinely timeless. So the stories are as new and as fresh and as interesting now as the day that we originally published them on the app. So it really is, I genuinely think that is a fantastic benefit. But you know this already if you already subscribe to us.
Okay, there you go, gift subs. Let's move on a little bit. There's a couple of newsy bits that we need to get through because yesterday was the final round of the 2022 Formula One season.
What a cracking season that was.
It started off with promise though, didn't it? I mean,
yeah.
Ferrari back in the hunt, it seemed. It looked like the Red Bull was fragile.
Yeah.
And then, of course, they got their act together and just steamrolled everyone, didn't they? Yeah. Certainly Max did.
Yeah, and so we're not really going to spend any time at all doing an autopsy on this year because, you know, we all know what happened and it was frankly a pretty dull season. I think we all know what people's hopes for next year are, which is that we have a more competitive season. What do you think is going to happen?
Well, I think Mercedes will. I think they understood the new regulations. I think they figured them out. You know, it's not as though they got the W13 this year's car to a place where it was consistently challenging, but it won a race. And I think Mercedes know the mistake that they made with the basic design of that car. And so I think they put that right with the new car over winter. I think probably they have a more competitive car. Now, they might be on the developmental curve a bit further behind Red Bull than perhaps Ferrari. But I think next year they become competitive more often. Because we can't write off Mercedes, can we?
No, we can't. And you're absolutely right. I mean, Toto Wolff was saying they knew from round one that they had a problem and it wasn't, you know, I mean they had the bouncing and the porpoising and all that sort of stuff, which, you know, they found a way of engineering out. But the fundamental design of the car was wrong and they couldn't change that. And yet, you know, as Mercedes always does, it got more and more competitive throughout the season. I mean, you'd never have thought that thing that they had in the early rounds was ever going to win a race, and yet it did. And, you know, George won that race entirely on merit. And so, you know, and also, you know, the other thing is, you know, they knew from the start that there was no way they're going to win the Drivers' World Championship. There was no way they're going to win the Constructors. They would have started work on the 2023 car very early. And I know that they certainly said that for the last few races, they just brought the same car. They didn't change anything at all. So they will have been hard at work. I also suspect that they really, really, really don't like losing, particularly to Red Bull, particularly with all this stuff that's been going on with the budget cap and everything else. So they will be back, you know, absolutely hard as nails and as hungry as there's ever been to put one over Red Bull next year. What's going to happen with Ferrari? Do you think Binotto is going to stay? All these stories, aren't there, that his time's up and, you know, they squandered again another championship winning opportunity. It seems that at the start of the season, they were right in it. And by the end of it, you know, frankly, they only just held off Mercedes for third in the Constructors.
But they won a handful of races. They were more competitive than they've been in for a long time. So if they're on an upward trajectory, surely just a little bit of stability now is what's needed. And I don't know, there's a ruthlessness about Ferrari, particularly when it comes to team principles. If you're judged to have squandered an opportunity, you seem to be out. Ferrari have denied that Binotto's position is in jeopardy. But that always happens.
That makes me worry for him even more.
Yeah, that always happens.
Yeah, yes, has my full confidence. Bang.
Yeah, off you go.
And yeah, I mean, I hear exactly what you say. But when you make that many mistakes, that doesn't strike me as being, you know, one individual messing up. or a bit of bad luck, or a combination of the two. That strikes me as being something that is fundamentally wrong in the organisation of the business, and it's just not, or the organisation of the team, and things are just not. You remember that quali, where was it, the last race but one, where they sent Child out on inters when everybody else was on slicks?
Yeah, you know, so what's going on there?
You know, what is going on? I mean, someone thought that was a good idea. And, you know, I feel really sorry, particularly for Charles, because, you know, I think he could have. And also the other thing was that if they maintained that momentum up until, I don't know, halfway through the season, and they were still over, you know, that would have inspired them to push on and on and on. But you know, the moment you get to the stage where actually you realise, oh, you know, Max and Red Bull, they've gone, we're never going to get that back. You know, heads go down and, you know, more mistakes get made. And, you know, I just want a competitor to see, you know, what we hope, obviously, next year is that Red Bull and Mercedes and Ferrari are at each other's throats from start to finish. I think there's a chance that will happen. I think you're absolutely right. I think Mercedes will come steaming back. I think actually Red Bull are going to have, I mean, so much harder a time next year than they've had this year. I don't see that we're going into, you know those periods like the Ferrari had at the beginning of the century, or Mercedes would just come out of, where you get one team which dominates for seasons. For some reason, I don't sense that happening with Red Bull. You know, they nipped it last year. They did very, very well this year. I think it's going to be tough for them again next year, and I really hope so. But to me, the great unknown is Ferrari. Whether they can sort themselves out. I really, really hope they can.
And yeah, you make a good point about Red Bull, because actually their competitors have done a bad job this year.
Yes.
Mercedes, was a pig of a car. They got it to some degree of competitiveness, but it was a pig of a car. And Ferrari just dropped the ball so many times. So the competition was so poor, it flattered Red Bull.
Yeah, Mercedes and Ferrari were the opposite of each other. You know, one team had, you know, ran a good car really poorly, and the other one ran a bad car really well.
Mm.
But when you've got another team out there which runs a good car really well, you get what you get, don't you? You get 17 wins.
And actually, the other point about Ferrari this season and why Binotto's position might be in danger is that for the first time in almost a decade, the Mercedes wasn't there. And guess what? Next year it probably is. So if that was Ferrari's opportunity to nick a championship while Mercedes
absolutely
was weak, it's gone begging,
absolutely,
isn't it?
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. So, yeah, you're right. It wasn't a classic season, particularly after the 2021. But let's just hope that we've got three teams at the front fighting for wins in the championship every other weekend. And maybe, you know, it'd be great to see McLaren a bit more competitive at times. Maybe
wouldn't it?
Some of the midfield moving forward.
Alonso and an Aston Martin.
Yeah, what's going to happen there?
Oh, there are going to be sparks, aren't there? I just, you know,
there are going to be sparks. It's going to be.
It's always wherever he is. It's always going to be interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, it'll be dramatic. We know that. Okay, well, let's leave Formula One behind. One more thing that I want to talk about before we get onto Jaguar Land Rover is Porsche. You were in LA last week at the LA Auto Show.
I was
with Porsche. Mostly to look at the 911 Dakar. It's a curious car, and we're seeing more of these things. We know Lamborghini are going to bring out a sort of lifted, slightly rally style Huracan. Others have looked at it. What do you make of this new breed of car before we get onto the 911 Dakar specifically?
What do I make of it? I think if it's, I mean, it's, well, on the one hand, it's a bit of fun. I like it when different stuff happens. You know, this is a kind of car that we haven't seen before.
Mm.
You know, do I really think that people are going to be driving their Dakar 911s, you know, across the sand at 107? No, I don't think they are. you know, it's clearly not going to happen. It's clearly going to be, you know, a sort of look at me thing. I don't think, but, you know, gosh, goodness knows, you know, how many cars, you know, like that, or very high performance cars ever get driven in the way they're designed to be driven. That's not what happens, is it? It's all about projection of the image. It's not about, I'm going to do this with this car. It's that if I chose to do that with this car, it could do it.
Yeah.
And it's about people. It's about, so, you know, if you think about, one of the great appeals of SUVs in terms of the image is it makes you look sort of sporting and adventurous and outdoorsy. And obviously one of the great appeals of a sports car is that it makes you look like a sort of sporting, go-getting, high-performance kind of person. So you combine the two, and you know the sort of the logic behind it isn't difficult to see. You know, they're not. It's not a very sort of serious thing. And, you know, I completely understand why Porsche have decided to limit it to 2,500 units. But from Porsche's point of view, it's not going to be a very expensive program to do. Will they sell the cars? You know, it costs, I think it costs like £3,000 less than a GT3 RS. It's a very, very expensive car. Will they sell them? I'd be surprised if they haven't already. Of course they'll sell them. So from Porsche's point of view, why wouldn't you? It's a great... it's a great image builder for them. It shows them being adventurous and interesting and different. They've got the heritage, you know, because they, well, actually technically it wasn't a 911, was it? It was a 953, but the 911 base Porsche 953 won the Dakar in 1984. And they've done that, that sort of quasi Rothmans livery, which you can get for another £18,000 or whatever it is. And I'm sure that everybody will having on, will have that on their car. And it's one of those, I think it's, we could do this, so let's do it. From Porsche's point of view, why wouldn't you? You know, I can't see it doing the brand any harm. They'll sell the cars, they'll make a stack of money out of it, and I can't wait to drive one. I just want to go, I mean, what I do find very interesting is it's got this this lift system on it. And I was talking to Frank Stefan Walliser, who now is the bloke who is in charge of all Porsche development. He is in charge of the way Porsches drive these days. But you know, until I think about 2 months ago, he was the person who was in charge of all Porsche sports cars. So he was Mr. 911, Boxster, and Cayman. And I was talking to him about the lift system and why lifts have to sort of come back down again at 20, 30 miles an hour normally in cars that have. And he said, well, because it's an aerodynamic thing, because you're only lifting the front of the car. And so you put a lot of adverse rake into the car. And if you go too fast with that, the car becomes aerodynamically unstable. If you do it at both ends, the rake of the car is unaffected. So you can go really fast. And so this thing, well, it's not only got 80 millimetres of ground clearance, you can do 107 miles an hour with it fully extended across whatever terrain you want to go across. And it's got these, it's got this, this sort of, you know, it's got off-road launch control, and it's got a rally mode, it's got an off-road mode, it's got all sorts of, you know, and it's fully armoured underside and all this sort of stuff. So, yeah, I mean, as I say, it's not a car that anyone's going to take particularly seriously, but I'm really, really looking forward to driving it. I hope that I do.
It's going to be a lot of fun. And I like the idea for two reasons. The first is that it comes with knobbly tyres and a taller ride height. So even on the road, just driving on a normal highway, it's going to feel very different to any other 911. It's going to be probably moving around a bit more, and it's going to roll and lean a bit more on corners. So it might be that it's fun to drive in a way that, you know, where most 911s are actually just locked down, flat, stable, grippy. So even on the road, there might be an advantage.
But you can get you can just get a standard P0 on it as well.
Okay, fine.
If you want that, But why wouldn't you have it on your Scorpio?
With the
chunkies.
A knobbly tyre, then, but the idea of clipping along a gravel track or some dry lake bed or something, I mean, it's the car sliding around beneath you, feeling like a rally driver. It's brilliantly evocative and exciting, and it sounds like the most fun in the world. How many people are going to rattle their £200,000 Porsche once you've got the Rothmans livery and a few other bits?
Oh, some will, but you know, they will be bazillionaires, won't they? You just don't care. But if you're the sort of person who, you know, is thinking about, oh, you know, taking a really, really deep breath, and you're thinking, right, well, you know, maybe I'm going to buy, I don't know, an MC20 or an Artur or some other, you know, recreational toy, and then suddenly this thing pops up, and you know, you bought a few Porsches in the past, and your dealer's given you a nod and a wink, and you think you can get one. There's no way you're going to be doing that to your near. It probably will be £200,000 once you put, once you've ticked a few boxes. No, but it doesn't matter. You know that you could if you wanted to, and that's what it's all about.
And, okay, so some people will use their cars that way. The thing is, here in the UK at least, if you want to go and drive along some gravel track, you probably have to hire a rally venue. We don't have gravel tracks, really. But in parts of mainland Europe, in California, huge parts of the US, there are places where you can go and tool around. So it might be that in other markets, there's sort of you know, there's more fun to be had in a car like this. But the fact is, I love the idea of these sort of lifted safari-style sports cars. I've just never driven one. So I'd love to have a go in one and figure out if the fun, you know, if the reality matches the expectation. Maybe soon.
Hopefully we'll find out.
Okay. All right. So we're actually talking about Jaguar Land Rover this week, because last week, Thierry Bolloré, the CEO, stepped down after only a couple of years at the helm.
Yeah.
I mean, it came as a surprise to us, but I think there are some people within the industry who weren't so surprised.
Yeah.
And he cited personal reasons. We don't know what they are.
No, but that sort of covers. That's the sort of all-purpose catch-all phrase, yeah. Isn't it? You know, you can conceal any number of reasons. That could be almost anything, couldn't it?
It could. So we don't know. We don't know what the reason was. We don't know if he was jumping before getting pushed. You know, maybe we never will know. But he's gone, or he's going. We now wonder what state JLR is in. JLR needs a new CEO. And of course, it's difficult to talk about JLR because it's not really JLR, is it? It's J and LR, because certainly the financial positions of the two companies, the two brands, it's chalk and cheese. And so this leaves us wondering exactly what Jaguar's future is going to look like, and it perhaps leaves Jaguar in need of a revival plan.
Well, I mean, does it? I mean, I think what would really help in trying to figure out where Jaguar should go is trying to figure out why Bolloré has gone. You know, he was the man who came up with this reimagined plan that's going to relaunch Jaguar as a premium EV manufacturer in 2025. And by premium, we think that means, you know, entry points to the range beginning with six figures. And, you know, that's punchy. That is for reasons that we will get onto. Now, you know, we here, because we are, you know, reasonably well connected and we know people in the industry, you know, I have heard so many reasons for his going. Well, I've heard that there were very profound personal differences with other people at Jaguar. I have heard that he lost the confidence of the Tata board, who ultimately owned Jaguar. I have heard that he was that the suppliers were being asked to come up with, you know, make huge investments for this, that, and the other to support the Jaguar plan when they didn't have any confidence that it was going to come off the way that it was envisaged. There are all sorts of reasons, and I suspect actually it's probably not one particular thing. I suspect that what has happened is that, you know, he has suddenly realised that he came there to do a job, and that he's not going to be able to, for who knows how many different reasons, and so he's off. And the problem is, I think it took them 6 months to find him. And, you know, well, I mean, on the one hand, you know, as we know, you know, the Range Rover bit of Land Rover, and I guess Defender as well, is highly successful. But on the other hand, the Land Rover brand has been, you know, not looked after the same way that Range Rover has. And Jaguar is a basket case. It really is. And if the man with the plan has gone, where does that leave it? I mean, it really, really worries me because, you know, I think we're going to sort of say the unsayable here about the future of Jaguar, because I think that there are two ways to approach it. On one hand, you think, well, Jaguar is this wonderful British marque, and some of the finest cars that have ever been produced by anyone anywhere in the world have been Jaguars. You know, we think about, you know, XK120s and Mark IIs and E-types and XJs and all these sorts of things. And then you think, well, actually, all that was a very, very long time ago.
It really was.
You know, yeah. The most recent of those cars I've just named, the original XJ, I think came out in 1968, which is, what, 54 years ago? It's over half a century ago. And Jaguar has been, you know, has frankly been, you know, a problem child for many, many years and for all sorts of reasons. And so the question is, the fundamental question is that A, can the brand survive? And B, can it survive by reinventing itself as this, you know, super expensive rival, frankly, to Bentley and Aston Martin. And it's a hell of a leap, isn't it?
It's a hell of a leap. And maybe we'll answer that question a little bit later on. So why are we talking about Jaguar rather than Jaguar and Land Rovers? Well, you've mentioned it, because Land Rover is in very good shape, particularly because of the Range Rover brand. And just to illustrate that point, the new Range Rover and the Range Rover Sport, which are proving very popular, inevitably, if they're on sale for 10 years, which could well happen, there is a chance that they will generate £100 billion in revenue.
Wow.
And so you can see, can't you, how Land Rover certainly could flourish, could thrive over the next decade or so with all that revenue coming in. And that's ignoring the Defender, which will drive an awful lot itself. So Land Rover is in a very, very different position to Jaguar. And it's the fact is, Jaguar has been living like a remora fish off the Land Rover shark for as long as they've been attached, about 15 years. And without that, would Jaguar have survived as long as it has done? It's a debatable point.
It wouldn't have done. So what has gone wrong with Jaguar? Because actually, if you look at the products that it has now, when they were new, there were some, you know, the XF was a good car when it came out. The F-Pace was a good car when it came out. The I-Pace was an outstanding car when it came out. You know, it has had some, you know, the F-Type when it came out was a great car. But what is absolutely staggering is that for 4 years, Jaguar has not launched a new car. And so, you know, they have these wonderful designs, these Callum cars, which look fantastic. They're actually pretty well engineered. And yet, all these cars, they've just always struggled to sell. So what is it? What has been the problem with Jaguar?
So the big gamble a few years ago was to get stuck in to the volume game in a big way, to really try and rival the likes of Mercedes, BMW, Audi. The trouble is, it never got to a point where it was properly competing with those marks on volumes. And so when you don't have the same volumes, you can't drive down prices with suppliers. You cannot amortize R&D costs across several different models. And that leaves Jaguar selling cars at the same price as Mercedes, Audi, BMW, but without the same investment in it. And so how are you going to make a better car than the Germans when you have fewer resources? And so how are you going to create a car that gives a buyer a reason to choose yours over the established German rivals? How's that ever going to happen?
So two points. One is, the point is about buying a better car. It has to be a better car. Making a car as good as a BMW 3 Series doesn't provide somebody who owns a BMW 3 Series with a reason to buy your car. Because it's, you know, why would you if it's only as good? It has to be better. And the thought that Jaguar, with the resources that were available to it, could make a car that was better than a BMW 3 Series, than the best compact, you know, saloons come estate that, you know, frankly, there's ever been, is hoping really quite a bit. But the staggering thing is, the XE wasn't the first time they'd done this. There was the X Type before that. Which, you know, if they hadn't learnt the lesson from that, which was exactly the same thing. The X Type, okay, it looked a bit odd, to be frank. But it was, you know, and it had Mondeo underpinnings. But it wasn't a terrible car. But it wasn't as good as a BMW. And it was doomed. And the thing about Jaguar, you think back to that list of cars I came up with just now, the XK120, the Mark II, the E-Type and the XJ. And actually, I include the I-Pace in this. Jaguar always has been at its absolute best when it leads and not when it follows. Because if it tries to follow the big guys, it will never have the same amount of money to invest in R&D or in marketing. And so the chances of actually doing the same job better are infinitesimally small. So what it needs to do is to do something else. And maybe that's what's behind this reinvention plan. We'll have to wait and see. But, you know, if Jaguar is destined to follow, Jaguar is doomed, in my view, because I just don't see them ever having the wherewithal to do what the others do better than they do it. So where is the incentive to go and buy a car that's not quite as good as a 3 Series, not quite as good as a 5 Series? There just isn't one. I mean, you are left with the sort of the iconoclasts, aren't you? The people who are just sort of contrarian by nature. And, you know,
the might buy a Jaguar. Buyers.
Yeah, exactly. Who will buy a Jaguar, not because they want a Jaguar, but because they don't want a German premium saloon, because everybody drives German premium saloons and that's boring. Well, that's not very many people. There's not a business in that. Not at those sorts of levels. You can't be a car maker like that selling, you know, if you're in the 3 Series market, selling, you know, a couple hundred thousand cars a year. You just can't do it. They're, you know, the margins aren't there. The returns aren't there. And you'll never get enough to invest in the next generation. So it's a flawed prospectus, to put it mildly.
I'm glad you mentioned I-Pace just now, because it does demonstrate that Jaguar, its days of innovation and leading weren't 50, 70 years ago. It has done it more recently. And the I-Pace was a brilliant car, and is a brilliant car. Probably it was very expensive to do. Probably it didn't make money, but Jaguar does have to be at the forefront, doesn't it? Because
they make the I-Pace in 2018. Suddenly, I can remember driving it and testing it against, I think, a Model S, something like that, and just thinking, this is just so much better. Jaguar had the best car of its kind in the world, and that kind being the kind of car that all cars in the future were going to be. And what do they do with that? Nothing. They invested in a brand new platform. They paid somebody else to build it for them. And you think, well, okay, so there'll be a long wheelbase one, and there'll be a short wheelbase one, and they'll have, four different body configurations, and they will spin an entire generation of new Jaguars off this fantastic new product with the head start that they have brilliantly created for themselves. They did nothing. They did nothing. They totally squandered it. Brilliantly styled, brilliantly engineered, beautifully built by its Magna in Austria, who built it. I mean, just, honestly, I get upset by it. It angers me, because who thought that was a good idea? Who thought that?
And you're right. It's not as though it was unsure if EV was the way to go. We all knew. But this is Thierry Bolloré. One of the first things he did was can the J-Pace, which I think was another big electric I-Pace. SUV.
And the
electric XJ.
Yeah. There will be some people who'll be glad that he's gone exactly those reasons that Jaguar had. And my understanding is that certainly the XJ, and I think probably the J-Pace too, my understanding is that they were both pretty close to, oven ready. What did it cost to can those programs? So
we know that it's got to be electric. We know that the volume game hasn't worked. They tried it with X-Type, tried it with XE, tried it with F-Pace. The volume game hasn't worked for them.
Yeah.
So does that mean that moving up market is the right thing to do?
Well, I mean, this is where the problem lies. You can move brands up market. I can remember, what it would have been, maybe 10 years ago, a dozen years ago, having a very serious conversation with a very senior person at JLR. And he was explaining to me how nervous they were about the possibility of putting a Range Rover on sale for a six-figure sum. They just didn't think, or they were very worried, that the Range Rover brand wouldn't command sufficient respect that it could break through that barrier. Today, the cheapest Range Rover you can buy is, I think, £99,375. Okay, so in that period of time, they have moved the entire Range Rover. I'm not talking about Range Rover Sports, but the entire Range Rover model line has shifted up so that a six-figure sum is now the least you can spend on one of those. But you can do that if you're in the game and through constantly releasing excellent cars and gently pushing and pushing and pushing, you can nudge it up, and then you get what's happened with Range Rover. Jaguar, what is the average price of a Jaguar? I mean, you pay early 30s for a base XE, going up to, 60, 70 for, an F-Pace or something like that. And then suddenly you're expecting people to spend £100,000 on one. It's a leap.
It's
a really, really big leap. And you're saying to people, you know, and rightly or wrongly, and it's another conversation, but people who really care about the badge on the front of their car. Don't have an Aston Martin, don't have a Bentley, don't even have a really, really top-of-the-range Porsche. Have a Jaguar.
And, okay.
It's so asking a lot, isn't it?
So does Jaguar have the brand equity to charge only that price point? And we have to be utterly ruthless in our assessment here, because we think of Jaguars quite romantically, and we think about the heritage, and we think about the racing successes, particularly in the 50s and at Le Mans later on as well in the 80s. And we therefore assume that Jaguar is a strong brand, an aspirational brand. But is it really? Are there people out there who aspire to own a Jaguar, or have those days just gone?
I think there are people out there who would love to own a Jaguar. I really do. I think Jaguar is one of those brands. I think it's like Lotus. I think it's like Alfa Romeo, where if you give them the right car, they will come. They will buy it. The question is, what is that car? And I fear, and my really, really big fear for Jaguar is that that car is a £50,000 middle of the range, executive, fast, beautiful, fine handling, whatever you want it to be, saloon, SUV, estate, whatever. But we know that that's not possible, because, you know, that market is so saturated with existing fine cars from much, much, much better resourced brands. And as per our previous conversation, Jaguar have tried to play that game and it hasn't worked. So what is left is to try and do something different, which is an approach that I applaud. But it is, you know, but it is so risky, because what is left is going, well, okay, we recognise that we can't follow the main bunch, and so we have to go somewhere else. And where else can we go where there is margin and therefore possibly profit? Because without margin, there is no profit. Well, we have to charge a lot of money for it. And so the question is, we come back to that question, is whether people will choose to spend £100,000 on a Jaguar. Now, maybe we got this completely wrong, because Jaguar are being, you know, they're not saying anything about this plan, are they? I mean, you know, I say £100,000, that's a number that, you know, I understand to be right. I might be wrong. It may be that they're thinking about £70,000, and, you know, maybe that's a different conversation. I don't know. But I just find it really, really hard. I find it, you know, that there is going to be the will now to back Jaguar, to spend that amount of money to relaunch a brand that basically, although, yes, of course, there are still endless Jaguars you can go out and buy. There's an XE, there's an XF, there's an E-Pace, there's an F-Pace, there's an F-Type, there's an I-Pace. They're all still on sale, but none of them have received anything more than the most minor, you know, model year updates for years. And so are you really just in the hope that there are people out there who love Jaguar so much they're going to spend an amount of money on one that they've never thought about spending before because it's a Jaguar? And if you don't think that, what's the alternative? The alternative, and I absolutely hate to say it, but the alternative is no Jaguar.
And is that... Okay, that's a very good point, because why is it incumbent on Tata or JLR to save Jaguar? They won't do it for sentimental reasons, because they feel it's the right thing to do. They will only try if they think they can turn it into a profitable business.
Yeah. And we know, don't we, that just because a brand's been around for a long time, that doesn't guarantee its future. Look at Saab, you know, look at Rover, look at, you know, there are no shortage of, you know, of brands which you just think, well, of course they're going to continue, because, you know, they've always been there. They'll always will be there. There are no guarantees in this business, particularly not now, with the world heading into global recession, you know, the chip crisis still being a very real thing, you know, in the most unstable, uncertain, frankly, pretty bloody depressing times of the recent, you know, in recent history. And you've got this thing which has, I mean, who knows? I mean, there's a thing I read that 20 years that Ford owned Jaguar, it never once turned a profit. And suddenly, with everything else and the fact that you've run the brand into the ground, you've completely neglected it for the last goodness knows how many years, you're really going to turn around and spend however many billions is required to completely relaunch it. And I mean, ultimate question, what would you do?
Okay, well, I'll turn that around on you. Is the right thing, therefore, for JLR to do, should they just lop the J off the front of their name and just be Land Rover?
It's kind of thinking the unthinkable, isn't it? You know, I really, 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 really... No, the right thing to do... No, the best thing to do, there's a difference, is to find a way for Jaguar to work, obviously. That's what everybody wants.
Absolutely.
But... And the question of, you know, people probably us included, spend so much time, you know, thinking about how Jaguar got to this point. It doesn't matter. It's where it is. You know, you play the hand you've got, not the one you wish you'd been dealt. And Jaguar is where it is now. And it's hard. It's hard to see. But then again, you just have to hope that there are people out there who are more committed, more intelligent, and know more about the nature of the resources that are available, who can see a future for it. I fear for it. I really do. More, you know, and I've been worried about Jaguar for, you know, when I first came into this business in 1988, you know, Jaguar was in one of those sort of rare moments of independence, and we were all just sitting there saying, please just get bought, please just get bought. And, you know, then Ford came along and we all breathed a huge sigh of relief. But then Ford started launching cars like the X-Type and the S-Type and, you know, and things got tough again. And then Tata came along and there was this brilliant new product came out under the, you know, under the Indian management. And we all got very excited again. And now we're in one of those troughs. And who knows? Usually what happens when these sorts of things happen to Jaguar is it just gets sold. And maybe that's what's best. Maybe there'll be somebody out there who are prepared to put in the billions, and let's not be shy about the numbers, the billions that are required to get Jaguar back on the footing. Because if you could do it, if you could create the right sort of car and you put a Jaguar badge on it and sell it at the right sort of price, people would buy it. It's not like the brand is toxic at all. I don't think it is. I really don't think that it is. I think it is a brand that people feel instinctively well disposed towards, and that, as I said earlier, if you gave them the right car, they would buy it. But it's really, really difficult to see how that can happen.
Nevertheless, imagine the company that you could make by getting rid of Jaguar, only building Range Rovers and their derivatives all the way down to the Evoque, and the Defender. If you only built Defenders and Range Rover badged cars, you would have an enormously profitable company that would tick along extremely nicely. There'd be no leeches sucking you dry. And so, given that these are commercial entities, why wouldn't Tata say, just do that? Just make money, just do that. We don't need to try to revive this brand, a multi-billion pound risk.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is, you know, if you are a gimlet-eyed, titanium-nosed businessman looking at this, that's what you do. And you forget about the job losses and the factory closures and the human beings and the human cost of all of this. That's why I would be so terrible at those things, because I would make subjective, emotional, terrible decisions, which would actually end up causing far more harm, because ultimately, you know, anything that I was in charge of would go to the wall, and instead of a small number of people losing their jobs, everybody would, because I just couldn't bear to be responsible for that. But, you know, sometimes you do need, you know, you do need the sort of the Carlos Ghosns and the Tavares, you know, the real, real hard-nosed people who will come in and go, this is necessary, and it's very sad, but if this company is to survive, this is what needs to happen. And, you know, who knows if we're getting to that point with JLR. But, you know, I would be more shocked than surprised if, you know, I don't want to think about it. I really don't. I mean, it's hard. It's hard because, you know, 2025. But, you know, the other thing which worries me is that, you know, we are right at the end of 2022 as we're recording this. You'd think we'd be hearing more. unless it's going to be the most fantastic da-da, rabbit out of a hat moment, if these cars are really, you know, given that the only cars that we know about, the J-Pace and the Electric XJ, are officially, you know, in the bin, maybe someone will dig them out of the bin, who knows. You would think with all the tittle-tattle and gossip, and you and I know so much more about what goes on than we can ever own up to. You would have thought that would be people talking about, oh yeah, we got this thing, and it's, you know, and the point is that if these cars are going into production in 2025, they're signed off now. Their designs are signed off now. They have to be, because these things tend to take between 5 and 7 years to do. And there are mules out there, and there's endurance system, there's durability, and you can't keep that all secret. So there is stuff, you know, if this big 2025 yeehaw moment is coming, then it is very advanced right here, right now, and yet we hear nothing. Maybe they are just so on top of things that they are, you know, the world's biggest rabbit's going to come out of the world's biggest hat. And I really, really hope so.
Okay. I think it's almost a mixed blessing that Jaguar is partnered, attached to Land Rover. Because, okay, Land Rover has kept Jaguar alive all these years. That's clear. However, opportunities for platform sharing between the two are severely limited because Land Rover builds high-riding 4x4s, off-roaders. Jaguars are not really that. You know, think about how happily Bentley sits alongside the VW Group with Porsche. You can build big four-door saloons on the same platform as the Panamera. You can build an SUV on the same platform as the Cayenne. That really works. The synergies there are clear. The synergies between a traditional Jaguar and a traditional Land Rover are almost none. Maybe powertrains. But is the solution there, then, that Jaguar needs to become an SUV mark? And it builds...
But it's tried, hasn't it?
Does it become purely that? Purely that? Spinning off Land Rover platforms, rebodying them. And then maybe, just maybe, we also know that those are the cars that buyers want. And just maybe you generate enough revenue there that you can build a single, bespoke, purpose-built sports car to keep that aspect of Jaguar alive.
Mm. Well, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because obviously there's been an element of that. We've had, you know, the F-Pace and the E-Pace, which are, you know, on shared platforms with JLR. I mean, the F-Pace, when it came out in 2015, 7 years old, that car. It was, for that kind of car, it's absolutely outstanding. A really, really good car. E-Pace was terrible, if I'm honest with you. Because, you know, and so if you like, there's sort of the yin and the yang of it, isn't it? And yeah, that's one example where the platform sharing worked really well, another one where it didn't work at all. You know, to do that, I guess, you know, you have to really invest in the SUV thing and think that that's going to hang around forever. I still don't think that it will, because I think ultimately, you know, high, heavy, you know, profligate cars are simply not the way the world is going to go. Ultimately, I think this adoration with SUVs will end. Then again, I have been saying this for over 30 years, so, you know, who knows when. But yes, I think if you were trying to create some kind of future for Jaguar, I don't really see any alternative, because that is at least an affordable way of doing it. And it had worked for the F-Pace. I mean, the F-Pace sold better than any other Jaguar, certainly relative to expectations, and was a good car. So it can be done, but it needs to be done well and with conviction, because otherwise what you get is the E-Pace, which, you know, just didn't do it. Well, certainly not for me at any level. So, oh, I don't know, Dan. It's, I'm not sure I've ever worried for Jaguar more than I have right now. And even if, you know, Tata just said, okay, enough, we don't know what to do with this, we're going to put it up for sale. Whose portfolio would it fit into?
Yeah.
You know, we think about other brands like Aston Martin and McLaren, which are not, you know, wholly owned by big OEMs. And you and I can both sit here and think about how they may fit very nicely into, you know, McLaren, for instance, if the rumours are true that BMW is pretty interested, you could see how that would sit very well with Mini and with BMW and with Rolls-Royce. You know, it's a high-performance brand, very nice, you know, fits the portfolio very well. It's harder to see with Jaguar, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah, I think it is. I think it is.
Without it duplicating something they've already
yeah.
got.
Yeah, there'd be lots of overlap. It's a tough one. And, you know, I think we've asked some fairly punchy questions in this episode, but clearly both
don't
of us
answers.
Want yeah clearly both of us want Jaguar to thrive and flourish.
Everybody does,
and so that is what we're hoping for, but we're realistic and it just looks extremely difficult at the moment, but who knows, maybe there is a plan, and we'll hear about it soon and we'll suddenly feel a whole lot better.
I think they've got one roll of the dice. If I'm absolutely, let's just be frank about this. I think they've got one roll of the dice. They need to recruit someone. They need to recruit a visionary. They need to go to someone and go, here is a career-making opportunity for you. And just someone who can command the loyalty and respect of everyone below him or her within the organisation and everyone above him or her at Tata. Someone who can gain the backing and just go, right, guys, we're going to go for it. And if that doesn't happen, I can't see a future for it.
Yeah. Ah, critical months. Critical few months. So let's keep our ears to the ground and see what happens. Okay. Listener question coming up then. You've not been briefed on this one, but I think you'll knock this one out without too much thought. But before I do that, remember that you can now give a subscription to the Intercooler as a gift in plenty of time for Christmas. 3, 6, or 12 month subs. Head to the-intercooler.com. There's a page on the homepage called Gifts, and you can find out everything you need to know about them. So the listener question comes from Matt Turner, and he says, what tech do you both actually want in a new car? It's a good question, because cars these days come dripping with tech that lots of us simply don't want. So he says, what do you actually want? For him, it's keyless entry, CarPlay, radar cruise. He'd have everything else can go.
Okay. Bum warmers.
Bum warmers. Yeah. Head up display.
Yeah, I like a head up display. Decent digital radio reception. I listen to the radio everywhere I go, and I hate it when it's because I live out in the boonies and it's cutting in and out. More than anything else, you know, what I just crave is an HMI, a human machine interface that works. You know, there are so many of them. Like I've got a Volkswagen ID Buzz outside, the big electric van. It's brilliant. Apart from that, and the infotainment system on it just drives me up the wall. It is so unintuitive. All the gizmos and gadgets that cars come with these days, I basically never use. The only one that's really worked for me, I had an S-Class in which had the Mercedes Me app. Which was really, really useful because, I mean, well, it was never more useful than when someone drove into it when it was parked in a car park and I was upstairs in a hotel room at the time, and the app told me. It told me that the car had been driven into, it told me where the damage was, and it told me that the damage wasn't serious. So I was probably at the car 2 minutes after it had been driven into. Now, I wasn't able to on this occasion, but I could possibly been there too. It could have made the difference between, you know, finding out who did it and not. So that was really useful. But, you know, we are going into an era, aren't we, where, you know, design is becoming increasingly important. And, you know, things will fill up with gizmos and gadgets because car makers faced with electric cars, which are all powered by the same things, are desperately trying to create differentiation. And so there's so much stuff, almost all of which is of no interest to me at all. I just want a car to work. That's it.
Yeah, agreed. Okay, well, there you go. Thank you for your question. Get your questions across, and we'll end next week's podcast with another.
Thanks all.
Mom
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.